Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hello, people. My name is Jimmy Wong, and welcome back to another episode of the Command Cast. I'm here with my co-host,
Josh Lee Kwai. What up, what up?
And we have a brand new guest today.
A what very is your special name?
Guest. Yes.
James Bianca, nice to meet you guys.
Nice. James, how are you doing today?
Doing pretty well. It's a good day in Los Angeles.
Nice. So, James, do you want to explain to everybody what you do for Wizards and Magic?
I am a new addition to the creative text team, which is responsible for the card names and the flavor text.
Ooh, cool. The card names and the flavor text.
Pretty
right,
sweet.
Right.
See, now, before you came on to this show, I had no idea that the people that wrote the card names also did the flavor text, and they're so intertwined.
I didn't know that either until I got the job. I thought it was only flavor text. I was delighted to find out that I would be able to submit the card names as well.
Now, I'm guessing you're a writer by trade. Nice.
I am, yes.
You got a degree in writing?
I just completed an MFA in creative writing from CalArts with an integrated media concentration. Very thoroughly deep into a novel. I've worked in newspaper journalism. Mm-hmm. I right now work for a branding and marketing firm as the lead writer, and I do freelance narrative design for other game companies in the gaming industry. Right now, I'm working with a company called Abracom in Belgium.
Belgium.
Yeah, I met them at the GDC. They're making a digital TCG called Faria, and it's browser based. And it's actually gorgeous. Like, beautiful, lush environments. The music is really atmospheric, and they love Magic. They were stoked that I had done this, and I'm sort of their full service guy. I'm right now composing and editing lore for public consumption.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, so how did you get into specifically like Magic and Wizards, and like what's your inroad to even start to do that?
Well, I've been playing Magic, you know, for years, and I know the game and the story fairly well, and in the summer before I went off to start this MFA, this writing degree, I had an essay in my heart that I wanted to write, but I didn't have the language for it. I didn't have the terminology for it. It was basically, I had been sort of wrestling with the question of why would you play with analog media? Why would you play with cardboard in 2014 when you have such a wealth of great gaming options with digitality and all of the interesting new dynamics that medium entails and enables? And so I ended up writing this essay, you know, in the first semester at CalArts, you know, in a class. Some of the readings informed me, you know, gave me some language I could use, gave me some frameworks. And I wrote a very dry, kind of ponderous academic essay called In Defense of Cardboard, Trading Card Games as a Remedy for Digital Fatigue.
Digital
fatigue.
Like,
you know, there's like stared screens all day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's nice to come home and like, you know, sit at a table with a cup of coffee and like something in my hand. And, you know, cards really do have this like physical art object quality to them. That's why people like foils, I think. But essentially I wrote this essay and I shopped it around online. I was looking for some kind of non-gaming platforms and venues. I was looking for just kind of academic journals, like media studies journals. I wasn't writing for a Magic playing audience. I was trying to explain this, to answer this question, and, you know, kind of explain myself to others.
Right.
And it ended up getting picked up at gatheringmagic.com, which is, you know, fairly
big
cool
Magic website.
Yeah, fairly definitely. Cool, you know, Magic venue, and the editor there asked me to stick around, and he was like, you know, I'd like to do more of this kind of long form theory based. You know, Magic journalism, you know, as such. If you want to stick around as a staff writer, you know, I'd be welcome. You'd be welcome to it. So I was stoked on that, and I stayed there. And there actually is a fairly robust community there of creative text writers on that team. And I met them. We all connected on Twitter and got some relationships off the ground. And eventually, one of them was like, you know, here is the in. And so I followed up on it. I applied and began my relationship with Creative, and they gave me a test, and I passed that test. And
can you talk about the test? That is fascinating. I like the idea of a test.
I can probably not talk about the test.
But there was a test.
There was a test.
I'm fine with that.
I produced, you know, writing for them that...
Oh, so the test isn't like Magic knowledge or past flavor knowledge or anything like that?
No, it's no.
Because like, I was like, man.
That would be
so
intense.
They can go in a lot of different directions. <it's> like,
no, it wasn't a lore trivia contest.
Oh,
because I would imagine like one of the requirements... Well... Here, let me ask you this first. Like,
sure,
you
sure.
said you played Magic for years, but how did you get into Magic? Like, how many years? Like,
well, I played as a kid. I mean, I was in fifth grade, like playing cards on the playground.
So you've been playing for a long, long time.
I stopped for almost a decade with a lot of people. Most of my peers stopped, and then I was in college, and a friend of mine came back to the dorm one day, and he had just come back from a game store where he had been drafting.
Nice.
And he put them down, and I was like, these are actually awesome again. I remember why I did this, and then I. I started playing and I started making a bunch of casual decks and eventually went to a store and started going to F&M's and the rest is history.
Nice.
Well, that's a funny thing about Magic. Like, I think anybody who had early experience with it, I mean, I'm the exact same way. Like, once that you've had that itch, like, it's going to pop back up, like, at some point in your life when you see them again. Like, you know, I was the same way. Like, start out basically when Magic started, fell away from it, then years and years later, you pick up some cards, you look at them, and it's like all of a sudden that part of your brain just turns on. And you're
like,
I got to scratch that itch again. And then, you know, it's just there's something about the game that just keeps calling you back.
I think it was my first introduction to the world of this kind of game. Mm-hmm. Like afterwards, I remember like I played World of Warcraft. I played MMOs trying to scratch that same itch.
Right.
But nothing really satisfied it as much as cracking cardboard did.
Oh, man, it's there's nothing like it. It's great.
So let me ask you, okay, like we were talking about the test, like, I mean, it seems like you need a lot of knowledge about the lore and the story. Like I said, I've been playing Magic since the start. I don't know much about, like, the cohesive story of Magic. Like, I know bits and pieces, you know, that I've heard here and there, but I've never, like, picked up, like, a huge volume that says, okay, here's how it goes A to B to C. I mean, I know about the Urza Mishra War and some of the Planeswalker lore and, you know.
About the Eldrazi.
Yeah, the Eldrazi and, you know, and sort of the recent stuff. Like, Theros makes, it's easy. That makes a lot of sense. But, man. Yeah.
Theros is clean.
There's very a whole clean. Bunch of stuff. Like, how much of that do you have to, did you have to, like, go into, like, study mode for a while to, like, what do they require?
Not really. I'm learning as I go constantly. I make great use of the various lore wikis that are available online. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times as I'm writing, we'll have a card concept and I'll be like, okay, the voice of this quote, I need, like, a blue trickster. So then I'll go into the lore and I'll be looking through the planes. I'll be like, okay, like, where can I find someone... Where's the, like, an in-game location that is producing this type of mage? Like, I need like trickster mages, and so I'll be like, oh, Vesva. Like, well, let me go read about that for a while, and then I'll go, like, I'll wander over there, and I'll come out with something very specific that was, you know, kind of came from a place of generality, but I'll follow that to the correct place in the lore.
Now that's I find that really just awesome, because you of course have to build upon prior lore to build new lore. And so at what point do you actually say, like, okay, I think I've decoded where this person should come from, what this person is like. Like, when do you decide, all right, this is when it becomes my character? You know, like, there is a breaking apart point where you are creating new lore.
Right. It's sort of gray, and I wonder. It's certainly up to the creative's discretion. You know, like, mm-hmm. they are the arbiters, and it's ultimately their game. You know, and so you'll submit content, and you'll submit an idea, and you'll be building upon something, and you'll maybe, you know, describe a sort of a dynamic of an institution, or, you know, like a kind of quality of, you know, a group of people, and you're making an imposition. You're really mm-hmm. adding something to that world. And creative, as the arbiters of it, as when they're reviewing the text and choosing what to actually print and what to truly give birth to, can just be like, no, I don't like that. Or they can be like, oh, that's awesome. Like, I really appreciate that. You know, let's run with that. Let's incorporate that into the mythos. And so, you know, it's when you really do come up with an original addition to it and you see and they accept it, it's a wonderful feeling.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I absolutely.
But it is totally their call.
Yeah. At the end of the day, of course. Yeah.
So how does it work, like, step by step? Like, do you see a card? Does it have full art? Do you see mechanics? Do you see, like, the text of a card? Do you see, like, casting costs and everything? Like, how early on are we talking? Like, can you bring us through the process a little bit? You know, obviously without getting specific.
Right. I can do so with a slight degree of distance. Basically, there is an online database, which all the writers log into, and we basically have the set available to us in various stages of completion. So we might see a card fully fleshed out.
Right.
It'll have fully completed art, and all that's left is our stuff. It might just be the mechanics and the place with a placeholder image and with the art, and it's actually this hilarious shot of Martha Stewart that you see all the time. It's just it's actually terrible to see her face, because you want to see the art. You want to see it.
It helps you, right? Yeah. You want as much as you can.
But, I wonder how many cards have been subconsciously influenced by Martha in this case.
I wonder, too. That's actually
why
a great
Martha
question.
Stewart?
I don't know. It's a joke.
It's a joke.
Image, yeah.
It's, I mean, mechanically, the cards are fully intact. Casting cost, creature types, everything. What the card does, R&D has settled on completely by the time it gets to us. And we are privy to the same art direction that the artists get. Presumably, the artists might actually get more than what we see, but we see art direction that I imagine is written for an illustrator. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, show us this kind of a mage on this, standing on this platform, whatever.
So you see the art direction also.
We see the art direction. It's
when
really
it's not
helpful.
Martha Stewart.
If we don't get Martha Stewart, we at least get the art direction. And you really need it. It's essential.
Right,
it's
absolutely.
It's 100% essential. And I think...
Well, the name and everything doesn't match up with the art, then you've got...
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's the atmosphere, there's this tone, and it just really informs your voicing.
Is there, like, a document that tells you the story of the set? I mean, for instance, we know Khans of Darkir is a wedge set. We know it's about warring clans. We know, you know, sort of, I don't know, one's in the desert, one looks like they're lizard people. Like, do they give you, like, a big thing that says, okay, here's the story of the set, like, so that you can start to, like...
We are very prepared. When we begin writing.
Right. I think that's a great answer, yeah.
Yeah, we have a great deal of material to work with and from which to draw our ideas and our content.
Now, when you're submitting for a card, I mean, obviously the flavor text and all that, like, what makes you decide between, like, okay, this is going to be someone's quote saying, like, Kiora is going to say something about this person in quotes, or it's something that the character itself on the card is saying?
Well, Creative asks of us to each... provide variety on a card-by-card basis.
Like, right.
You submit multiple submissions for quotes, for names and quotes, for each card. And
really quick, how many people are working on the same set at any given time?
It varies on a set-by-set basis.
Are we talking like 100 people, or are we talking 10 or less?
Much smaller, single digits.
Oh, okay.
It's a very tight, hand-selected team of writers.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing what the other people are...
Yes.
Submitting?
Yes, and that's actually a great dynamic because it's there to prevent redundancy.
Right,
so,
that makes sense.
And like, you know, you get in there and it's like, oh, God of Revels, like that, I'm not going to submit that. Someone else has done that. And if we didn't see that, we might all submit that.
Right.
However many writers there were on the team.
Right.
Of that same thing, and that really impoverishes the submission pool for them.
Mm-hmm. So, definitely. Mm-hmm. And also being able to see the other writer submissions, I'm guessing, also helps you keep inside your own world, so you're sort of building your own grammar and sort of pacing for your own flavor text in relation to each other.
Or riff off each other, you know, building each other. Mm-hmm. Like, if someone's got a cool character that they made up in a quote and they're attributing quotes to it, like, maybe make up something else and run with that. And like, it's great. And it should be friendly. You know, it should be totally friendly and collaborative.
Right.
And of course, there's a little bit of competition because it's like, you know, you all want the names. Yeah, you all want it. It's exciting. But,
yeah. Well, that's actually another interesting thing I want to ask about, in that because you're starting from a different, you know, you're coming at the story and the characters from a different standpoint, which is, you know, the mechanics of how they work.
Right.
And not like we're starting from the ground up. This is this person in relation to this person, et cetera, et cetera. You can sort of just add names to the mix. I mean, what does that allow you as a writer? Is it freeing? Is it scary? I can imagine that's a lot of emotions.
It's exciting. It's for me. I mean, I found it a wholly positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
For Khans, I tried to create a sort of repeated cast of characters, you know, to whom I would attribute quotes as I proceeded through them. And I'd be like, oh, I would see a card and I would have this, like, you know, some sassy quote that I would write for it, and I'd be like, oh, that's totally this guy's voice, and it would be his quote, and it would get it. And I would sort of scatter those submissions across the whole set.
But you're creating characters with their own voice.
Right.
That's very interesting. Is that risky, though, from your standpoint of, like, if they don't like that voice, all the submissions for that one voice are gone, right?
They have the ability to edit anything you do. So they could delete the attribution. They can change a lot of it. A lot of my acceptances were from cons were edited in order to match their wizard, you know, creative's voice.
They do their own pass, basically, at the end.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, if they're taking from a certain number of people, they need to unify it, right?
So, right. And they might just throw away all our submissions entirely. And to keep, and stick, you know, keep with the working title.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that happens.
Yes, that happens. And I imagine, you know, I imagine God of Revels was set in stone from the moment that, you know, Xenagos was, you know, conceived as a character. Khans is actually my first set. I have not actually seen a card in print yet. I am so excited for this set to print.
I hope you get many foils of that card.
Do you know at this point exactly which of yours were?
Yes,
okay.
I can say that one of the pieces of art that has been spoiled. Is a card that I named. They didn't spoil the name, and I won't say which piece of art it was, but I was very excited to see that.
Very
excellent.
Awesome. That's
great.
Awesome. That's
awesome. We're going to have to check back in with you after it comes out so you can tell us, like, maybe
definitely.
What...
Yeah, definitely.
I'm going to have to find a creative way to display, you know, the portfolio of work that made it through.
Do you find yourself going back to cards in the past and looking at them as sort of inspiration?
Constantly.
What's a favorite, like, go-to card where you're like, man, the flavor text or the name of this card is great, and I'm trying to replicate that when I can, or or draw inspiration from that when I can.
I show people Goblin Assassin a lot.
Uh-huh. It's kind of
kind of a weird card.
Flip a coin, right?
Yeah, I don't even remember. Yeah. It's a coin flip card. I don't even remember what set it's in. I just pull it up as a demonstration to particularly non-Magic players to be like, okay, this is what flavor text does. Like, here is how it narrativizes what's
happening. What's
the
flavor text on the Goblin Assassin for those that don't know?
Well, first, the card, it's really important what the card does.
Right.
It's
an amazing creature.
It's a red goblin guy, and you flip a coin to, and you choose a creature, I believe, and you flip a coin, and if you get it right, he kills the creature, and if not, he kills some other creature. It's like he's really bad at his job. He's a terrible assassin.
Right. Well, actually, no, I have it here.
You
so
it?
It's cool. 3 and 2 red for a 2/2. It's from Legions.
Nice.
And it's whenever Goblin Assassin or another goblin comes into play, each player flips a coin. Each player whose coin comes up tails sacrifices a creature. So anytime any goblin comes into play, this guy kills or may potentially kill a lot of people.
Right. So the quote on it is, would you like to read it?
Yeah. The more victims he kills, the more likely he is to get the right one.
Exactly. So
that's pretty good.
It's so goblins, and it just perfectly explains what that card is.
My favorite flavor text of all time is a goblin. It's Goblin Grenade. The text is, if only we could teach him to throw the blasted things.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, I feel like goblins, you know, as a race, as a trope in fantasy, I think are handled with nowhere near the amount of like affection and originality than, you know, elsewhere in the genre than they are in Magic. I agree.
I think
goblins are most at home in Magic.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember when I got back into the game, I was like, oh, cool, like a Greek god mythology set. Like I saw what the sets were called. Even just saying Theros, I was like, mythology, Greek gods,
right?
Without even having to see a single card from the set, so I was really happy because it was so flavorful. All the god cards I thought were really fascinating in the way, and the enchantment creature idea. So I, at first when I saw it, I was like, "This is a really cool idea. This makes a lot of sense for a god to only be active when there are enough people on the field, like chanting that person's name." You know,
right.
It felt very flavorful in that way. So sometimes I'm thinking though, you get a card with a mechanic and the flavor text that you want to make for it may betray what you think it actually should be. Does that ever happen? Where the flavor text sort of reverses what you want to do with the mechanic, or the mechanic does something where you're like, well, I kind of want the flavor to be more in this realm.
I mean, again, it is, as a writer on this team, you know, it is not my game. And ultimately, like, I'm playing by their rules. And so, and to the end of the, day, you're also kind of writing in their voice a little bit. Like, you learn the naming conventions. You know, where you're like making little compound adjectives to, you know, modify like Thrinax or whatever the noun is. You know, you kind of play by their rules, and it's actually a writing prompt each time. And
that's awesome. Yeah.
And I think that's actually part of one of the things you learn as, you know, as as an artist who has monetized and is continuing to you know, be professional and actually you live off of art making. You don't exist in a vacuum.
It's almost impossible to make your living at art if you're going to be uncompromising.
Oh, absolutely. No one's going to want to work with you.
You might make some weird art too. Let's not kid around. Sometimes having
it's not impossible. It's just almost impossible.
Right?
Yeah.
For the select few,
you can do it. But you almost have to earn it.
Yeah.
You know,
You can almost never start out by doing that. And you can very rarely ever get to the point where you are like that. But
I mean, I'm only 26. Yeah. Like,
well,
I'm
it's a mature standpoint to have.
Yeah, definitely. So do you think... Oh, yeah, go for it.
When you look at a card, when you go to the page and you bring it up and whatever's there, there's a mechanic, there's a temporary name, there's Martha Stewart, whatever there is. Like, what's your first step is like, okay, I'm going to start to tackle this. Like, what's the thought process behind, like, how do I begin to come up with what the flavor text or the name might be?
I actually kind of click it a bunch, and I like move around, and I freak out, and I look at other cards, and then I come back, and it's like, or
look at other
like,
cards from other sets that are already
in the queue, the thing. Like, if I don't have an idea immediately, I'll go elsewhere, and I'll like maybe sleep or whatever, and I'll come back.
Do you have an idea immediately, and how often do you not? I mean,
often. I'll look at a card, and I'll be like, oh, sweet, I'll move through a couple of things, but I might also immediately delete them and come back later. And you make a couple of passes. I make a fairly heavy use of the thesaurus because it is often very helpful. Like,
a very handy book.
No, it's a handy tool. I mean, you know, you have an idea that you might have. A word might appear in your head. Like, you might look at a concept and you might have an adjective, or you might have an idea like, okay, like this has to have like a celestial quality, but celestial is an inappropriate word here. So I will begin with celestial in the thesaurus, and I will wander through it until I have either seen a word that is appropriate or another one has occurred to me.
Right.
I mean, often like the like an online thesaurus is not so much going to produce the word that you need, but will kind of galvanize your thought process to the point where you arrive at it independently on your own.
Yeah, right. I call this searching for sparks.
That's great.
As a, you know, Jimmy and I both obviously work in the movie biz, so yeah, we're in the creative field, and I always call it like, I'm just looking for the spark, and then I'll fan that into the fire. But without the spark, it's really hard to make that fire. So all you do is just run around all the time.
Yeah,
just
you
like,
pick through the ashes.
Is this hot enough? Is this hot enough? Yeah, exactly. There it is, and then you blow on it a little.
Definitely. And then you take it into the gatherer or magic cards, you know, .info, and some database, and you look and see what else is there. For instance, with dragons or something with like an established creature type, those have a naming convention. Dragons, as far as I can tell, they are either blank dragon or blank hellkite, like most of the time, you know, and you know, that is a convention that wizards.
Yeah, you never see one that doesn't have one of those two.
Yeah, it's pretty, you know, unless it's a legend.
Or like dragon whelp would be the only thing, but it still has dragon.
It still says dragon, you know, and so like, you know, as someone who would like wizards to accept my content and then pay me for it, you know, I'm going to look and see at what they've, you know, what
the rules they've sort of established without the unsaid rules.
Follow the precedent, because at the end of the day, this is their game. And you are participating in it. And the things that are most in your voice are the ones that are very likely the least in theirs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of my babies died. Like when I was looking at my acceptances and cons, like I was very excited. I was very happy with my performance. I love a lot of the stuff. But I also I mourned some of the content that didn't make it through. And I was like, man, there were some really, I labored on some of those things, but they were me. They were very much me.
Right.
That's the thing about all this contract work, though, that's creative, is like, you know, you're always going to be in that position where like your favorite stuff doesn't. I call it the aliens. You know, it's like you do this thing. It's like for you, it would be naming a card. For us, it might be writing a scene or whatever it is. But then, you know, and it's perfect in your mind. And it's like you look at it from 20 different directions and you can't poke a hole in it and you can find no flaw in it. And then an alien from the planet like. You know, Alpha Centauri comes down and they smell the color blue. Like they don't have this, and then they are going to pass judgment on it. It's like you can't judge what another person's going to think about your submission. Mm-hmm. So it's a mature standpoint that you have.
It's an artistic maturity that is, I think, necessary of anyone taking this seriously. Like you really have to be able to, in writing, one of the rules is, you know, you hear show don't tell all the time.
Right.
But one of the, you probably heard, I'm sure you guys have heard this, but kill your babies is all the time. And it's like, you have to be ready to let them go. You loved them, but like at the end of the day, the real baby is the final product.
You have to love it to make it good, right?
Of course.
Right. So you can't get to this point where like you don't actually pour yourself into it, because then it'll just suck from the get-go.
You have to love it as hard as you can while you're nurturing it and while you're creating it. And then you have to immediately let go. You have to,
that's
have to
the great, learn cruel how to let go. Paradox
it's
of it all.
It's painful. It's definitely hard. Yeah.
On that somber note, let's move into some cons of Tarkir. What comes first for you? Like, do you look at the mechanics and decide the flavor, or do you sort of look at cards as a whole and then decide that from there, or do you really focus in on the cards?
There is a lot of art direction, and you know, we see the whole card itself, and so it's often very clear what they want, and it's up to us to come up with an inventive way to express that.
There times when it's not clear what they want, or they maybe don't know?
They might say like, this is open ended, like, you know, this this can change, and that's exciting. That's wonderful.
We've heard stories from people at Wizards about flavor text and art changing cards. Have you seen that? Like where
changing mid development? You mean, and we have to go back in and restart?
No, I mean like what you're doing informing what they're doing, sort of tail wave the dog style. I've heard like art coming in and them being like, well, this art's awesome and it looks like this, and let's change the card to match the art.
Right.
Like, have you heard or seen anything where flavor text changed?
I haven't witnessed that, or I haven't had that experience. Mm-hmm. But that sounds wonderful. I'm glad they do that.
Just keep working, man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it'll happen someday.
Definitely.
So I believe.
So for the Constantark here, obviously there are five clans. Now, did you...
Oh, let's talk about really quickly, because this is a big point about this set, is the names of...
The clans.
And there's a lot of debate right now online and otherwise about people are like, oh, I don't know if I'm ever going to get used to saying this. And it's by the way, you'll get used to
it. You'll definitely get used to it. Yeah. Right?
I mean, we all say Grixis, don't we? Like, come
Grixis
on.
Grixis is awesome. And,
yeah,
and
but
so
nobody
they,
said
like,
Grixis 10 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't worry, you will say it. But that, like, there had to be a lot of weight, because I'm assuming Wizards knew, like, this is going to be what these three color combinations are called till the end of time. So,
yes.
So, what was that process like specifically for the clan names? Were you involved in that?
I was not at all. No, that was set in stone before we even.
They had already decided on that internally.
Wizards
before.
Does a great deal of world building before we're privy to anything.
Right, right.
We show up to a pretty complete world.
And you guys are kind of like the sprinkle of magic on top.
Absolutely.
Not to be
redundant. You know, and so when we're injecting new characters or embellishing on one that exists, you know, mm-hmm. those are liberties. Those are risky. It's actually probably safer if you're trying to get more acceptances to just stick to a more direct expression of something.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
But what's the fun in that?
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you want to be inventive,
you
want to be imaginative.
You didn't get creative to be safe.
Yeah, we're not technicians here. We're world builders too.
So with all these clans, did you with your submission process and what you take and what you try to do, did you start with each color? Did you start with each clan? Was there any process?
I just went right down the list alphabetically. Mm-hmm. I did not use any of the sorting tools that are available to us to group by color or rarity. I tried to once and it immediately threw me off and I just undid it and went back to what it was, because I liked being shaken out of my comfort zone. I would move from one card to the next and it'd be in a completely different color, completely different rarity. I enjoyed that. I needed to be surprised. I got stale if I tried to do it the other
way. No, you said you were creating some characters that you would use their voice continuously.
Right,
did
right.
you, like, how far deep, how deep into that do you go? Do you start writing backstories for those characters? Do you create, like, how much of, in your mind, I mean, obviously this is not necessarily.
I did no background writing, myself. Their faces and their voices and, their day-to-day, their mm-hmm. habits, that starts to kind of
like you paint
organically
a picture?
Yeah, arise in your own heart. Like the mm-hmm. way any character that, right. you know, that you're commanding in a fictional context, like that, you know, they start to take a little form.
Can you tell us your favorite clan from Karns of Tarkir?
I'm torn between the Sultai and the Jeskai.
Ah, they are, nice.
Is that because they rhyme?
No.
I'm all about Jeskai. I like Jeskai
a
lot.
The flavor for both is just so rich and wonderful. I love Bug as a as a color,
right.
as a color triplet, and so I was really, really just blown away by the way they married all of those color identities into one. It's something so cohesive, and I can't really embellish upon it. I can just point you to the art that's been spoiled of the Khan Sidisi. And the other one of a bunch of dudes posing.
I love that.
This just proves my point also that anyone from early Magic, because you notice he picked the two clans with blue in it. Anybody
true.
From early Magic, blue.
They know. Blue. It's all
blue's
about blue.
What's up? Blue's
just, what's up. Just kicked too much ass early on.
You can't stray too far. But the Sultai are, their adjective, I believe, is ruthlessness. That was the spoiled mm-hmm. one. They
ruthlessness are, and manipulation is what they're about.
They are so wonderfully villainous in that sense. It's just they're
that's my favorite.
They're just delightful.
I mean, right now, until we go to the pre-release, and I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be Mardu every time I can.
Yeah. That'll be fun. But but the Jeskai, are on the other side of that. I'm much more like. Much more heroic and
cunning and tricks.
Yeah, it's the cunning and the tricks. It's not so much a rogue thing as it is a wisdom.
I see. So using your knowledge to win the battle.
Well, they're the eye of the dragon, and so it's about sight and insight. And it's as we can see, it's very martial arts themed. It's this kung fu kind of mythical China vibe to it, and so it has a very contemplative. Contemplative nature to it. And for me, that was great because, I studied abroad in India and Nepal studying Buddhist philosophy.
You got Eastern philosophy.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. So I was right up your alley there.
Right, right. So, I mean, I saw the Tibetan flavor. I saw the architecture and the clothing in the Jeskai, and I just went ape. It was amazing. I went to the library and I pulled out a bunch of texts on Tibetan mythology, and I started getting into a bunch of old legends just to see how the stories were being told, how those mm-hmm. fables were structured, and like the tone of them, and like are they playful like Native American stuff? Or are they really brutal and metal like Norse myth? Like what is their character? And it was just so mystical and super transcendent all the time, like people transforming into the various. Other things.
Right.
I mean, interestingly, without getting specific, did you find that passion for those specific clan like translated into more of your submissions being accepted for them than maybe others, or?
Not necessarily, no. Huh. No, I'm pretty scattered across the set. I had a lot of...
I think that speaks to you as a writer in that case, because, it just means you are consistent across a bigger part.
I had affection for...
There's this misconception, I think, in creativity that somehow like passion always translates to the work in the end, and it doesn't. Like a lot of times, elbow grease actually wins.
Yeah,
and beats passion in the end. Like that. Let that be a lesson to everybody out there.
Yeah, you might be totally uninspired by something on its face, but then when you actually start to do it, you start
when you grind it out.
Yeah, you grind it out, and something pretty solid comes out. And,
yeah,
I think there's this idea though, young like emerging artists, where it's like, you know, that because that stuff's way harder to do, and like your brain wants to tell you like, and it won't be good in the end.
Right,
but
right.
That's not true. Like, yeah, sometimes the hardest stuff is the best stuff when it's over.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Going back to cons, we know the morph mechanic is returning.
Yes.
Is there? And
morph
being,
is back.
Yeah, and being a longtime Magic player, like, were you excited to see that back? Were you?
I actually did not play with morph, or remember doing so when I was younger. I think morph had its dominant presence when I had departed from Magic for a while, and it was not really active when I came back in. This is actually going to be one of my first times playing with morph
in
that context, but flavor wise. It's very clear what he's doing, and it's extremely fun. You know, you want to get in there, and you want to have the, you want to really have all the dynamics that are in play with morph mechanically. You want them to be present in the language, so you want there to be, a sense of sudden emergence. Like you want there to be like dynamism and change, and
right?
Or if not in the actual text itself, it should be heavily implied that like you know. Something is going to emerge here, and it's going to have an effect.
Right.
It's going to have a dramatic effect.
It's morphing into existence.
Yeah, right. And so there's this veiled kind of ambient quality to it in its morph state, and then there's just this like violent ambush quality as it emerges. And you know that is inherent drama right there. That's just like a soft pitch over home plate.
Right, right. Yeah,
like, that is awesome. It's tons of fun to work with.
You spoke about this with one of your favorite cards, Withinger Unbound. Cards that instead of having a split face or two cards on the same card, it is more. You know, you'd rather prefer the card that flips over because it has that inherent drama.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I don't prefer it per se, but I appreciate what it's doing.
Right.
In terms of enacting the flavor mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
The article you're referring to was an article I published on GatheringMagic.com. I called it the top 15 most flavorful cards, which was a terrible misplay on my part because it was truly a misplay. Yeah, no, absolutely, because it was less so the most flavorful cards. It was more of 15 cards that very clearly demonstrated a tight correlation between flavor
and mechanics.
And mechanics.
Yeah. Right.
Flavor that expresses what mechanics are doing and mechanics that carry out what flavor describes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to pick cards that really there's really like decreasing separation between those two processes as you get down to number one. And Withengar was my number one because I feel like Withengar does everything. Like Withengar, there's so much drama in that. You take it out of its sleeve and you turn it over, and the card frame is different now. It's gained a color.
It's gained a creature.
It's gained a type.
it's suddenly
it's like legendary now. Was the artifact legendary to begin with?
It may be.
It might be, yeah.
If you guys don't know,
I know Jimmy smacked me in the face with it the other day.
Metaphorically. We'll read the card. It is Elbrus the Binding Blade, is what it starts at. It's a 7-drop legendary artifact equipment.
Right.
And all it does to equip for one is gets +1/+0, and you're like, wait, hold on
a second. Something's going on here.
Yeah, and it's got great flavor text on the front.
Well, the equip cost, too, is important. It's only one.
One to equip, yeah.
It costs 7 to put out.
That's
exactly
narratively meaningful.
Yes, very much so. And then when equipped creature deals combat damage to a player, unattach Elbrus the Binding Blade and transform it. So flip it over. And the text on the front is, those who grasp its hilt soon hear the demon's call. And there is definitely a demon on the back. It's called Withengar Unbound. It's a 13/13 legendary creature demon that's flying, intimidate, trample. And anytime a player loses the game, you put 13 more +1/+1 counters on him.
Right. So this artifact costs 7 to begin with because it's difficult to obtain, right? It is truly a legendary dagger. You had to go through great lengths to acquire it. But once you have it, it's very easy to use because it wants to be transformed.
Yeah.
The demon inside of it is like, you know, the way the ring, you know, entices the ring bearers to do things. It's like it wants you to do it. And so when you draw blood with it, it abandons you immediately. And it flips over and it now becomes this outrageous monster. And it's fantastic.
Fortunately, you're still in control of it.
Right.
I always thought it should kill the creature that it was equipped to.
I think so. That would have been icing on the cake. I think that would have been great.
And not just kill, it would say murder.
It's a great EDH card. Well, it did murder me, so that was...
It's quite powerful.
That's a wonderful card.
I want to talk about a card now that we're on the subject.
Of course.
King Makar.
Ah,
yeah,
the Gold Curse.
Yeah, the Midas analog.
Yeah, let's talk about King Makar. Why is it a May ability on that card? I mean, you have to be up in arms about that as a flavor guy, right?
Can we go over the rules once?
Yes.
The text,
let me pull up King Makar, the Gold Curse. And if anyone doesn't know the story of Midas
and
King
Midas. Oh, do you have
Midas.
A choice of...
You have a choice.
Of whether the...
You should not have a choice.
No, you should not have a choice. That's the point of the of King Midas' like, conflict.
They've caught in a lot of flack for this, but I just... You're an official flavor guy, and...
Yeah, that seems... That hadn't occurred to me, actually. I looked at that card, and I was happy that they had done that. I was happy to see Midas being brought into the
right.
into the fold. You know, way like Fleece.
Oh, it's an awesome card. Like,
yeah, it's great.
It's so flavorful, and yet they messed it up with the
just one. Sometimes all it takes is the letters M A Y, and that'll change the card entirely. But so King Makar is a 2/2 black. He's the Gold Cursed. If you guys don't know about King Midas and the Midas Touch. Very famous story. You should look it up. He says, inspired whenever King Makar, the Gold Curse, becomes untapped, you may exile target creature. If you do, you can put a colorless artifact token creature named... Oh, not sorry, not a creature. Named Gold on the battlefield, and you can sacrifice it to add one mana of any curse.
So basically, he's like turning everything into gold, right?
Yeah. Anything he touches.
But the curse of Midas was that he had to do it. Right?
If he touched anything, it became gold. And there's the sorrow there. He can't love. He can't
eat. It's melancholy. Yeah,
you know, it's brutal. And
he may never
hold anyone. It's untenable. Like,
you
can't survive if you have that power. It sounds great at first, and then it's like, oh, that's going to...
Yeah, it's going to ruin my life.
If he had been a mandatory trigger, that would have eventually there'd have been no creatures in the battlefield, presumably.
Has to
and
turn
he could
himself.
Have done himself in
yeah,
and
he
that
had
is
to
so
himself.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
it is. Right?
That would have been great. Yeah.
Our friend Will was saying this is how you achieve true sadness and true like actual loss is when it's not when you've done something wrong. It's knowing it's too late.
Right. Yeah.
After you've done something wrong. It's you're past the point.
I'm very happy to see Magic doing this. Really like incorporating real world mythos into the game itself and running with it, you know, and in Khans of Tarkir, I mean, there are various historical regions that each of the clans reference, and that's visible.
Right.
And it's visible in the art. They have the trappings and like just like the.
There's definitely like Mongolians. There's definitely like
Those are really exciting as a writer to work with because you get to do a great deal of historical reading, and it's exciting.
Yeah,
it's fun reading. It's like it's ritual and violence and.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and drama.
Colors do definitely like to match up with that as well.
You know, one other thing to touch on is that it's a time travel set.
I don't know anything about that.
So they didn't actually.
No,
that was my question.
I'm as excited as you guys are to learn about how that is going to take place and how that's going to play out. I saw the set of Khans of Tarkir. I saw the. I was given sufficient information to write about it and no more. Mm. It was a completely need-to-know basis. I have no idea what the block is doing. I remember hearing very early on with the rest of the Magic community on Reddit and such that there was going to be an unconventional structure to the block. And I was like, really? In what way?
It's
interesting. I have no idea.
It's interesting because you would think that with the time travel, like they would want cohesion between
the
references,
the
right?
Who knows? Right.
Yeah, because... Yeah. Huh.
I mean, I can fully speculate with you guys. Like, I love the idea of bringing. We know that the dragons are extinct on Tarkir at present day, and I love the idea of returning to a past in which they are not.
That sounds
exciting.
Or turning to a future where they are.
Right?
As well.
Yeah.
You
an
never
an alternate
go,
future. Maybe we go back to the past.
Well, I think we go.
Set.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
And then we end up
go
with
back
the,
to the past. And then
a sort of parallel timeline in the third set, as you know, to
exactly.
mimic.
They're going to retcon it.
Yeah, that,
they're gonna retcon that world, and then there'll be dragons in the future.
I can't wait.
It sounds great. Yeah, I would love to see them do it. It sounds like a.
I'm also very excited
because
usually time travel cards are take an extra turn, and it's like that's kind of flavorful. You just pay a lot of mana, and you like swirl around this mystical ball, and look, you get another turn. But I'm really excited for time travel in this case because I think it's gonna do some really fun stuff. I hope.
I would think it would open up a lot of doors for flavor. Like, let's say, for instance, you've got all these characters and they speak in a certain voice, but then somebody goes back in time and changes the time space continuum, and now all of a sudden they're different characters than they were in your set.
So let's because we do have a couple of cards spoiled to us in cons, we can definitely talk about them, and I'd love to hear your opinion on the flavor of them.
Yeah,
and
let's talk about it.
Especially this first one is Zergo Helm Smasher. And one thing I noticed on here that I didn't even think about is that there's no room for flavor text on this guy. He is all mechanics.
No, he's doing quite a bit.
Yeah. So when it comes to something like that, I mean that must be fun as well. Now you only get to do the name for this character. And did you find that you have to sometimes give a little more to the name?
You have to give a lot more to the name. If you only have the name to convey what's happening in it, you have to be so careful. Every one of those letters, if there's a hyphen or not, it's all very, very clear. You have to be super precise. So it's actually a lot more pressure to successfully
definitely.
Execute.
You got to do more with less.
Yes, you have to do a lot more with less. Yeah,
let's read this card, though. He is Mardu. He's 2 red, white, black, 7-2 with haste. He attacks each combat if able. He's indestructible as long as it's your turn. And whenever a creature dealt by him dies, put a +1/+1 counter on
him. Yeah, he's just a beater.
He's a beater. He is a helm smasher.
Yeah, that dude is swinging in.
Somebody named it good. I don't know if it was you.
I wasn't me. I did not name that. We know that the Mardu are, what is it, speed of the dragon.
Yeah.
And I think
definitely
the kind of the forces at their back and visible in the imagery, and then the colors themselves and our familiarity with what those colors typically do, especially in, I guess not necessarily in conjunction because we so rarely see that, but, it's the Mardu horde.
Yeah,
you can tell by the text on it.
I think we have an idea of what they're going to do, especially given what their leader does. And so that's very exciting. That was very, very exciting to write about because it's just ferocity. And
right,
it was just testosterone the whole time. So when I was doing Mardu cards, I was just channeling my inner jock, and it was just straight like beer can crushing, like
nice.
just axe in the sand kind of writing, and that was great. Like, there's a place for that because there's also each of the other clans are so different. Like the Jeskai would never behave in that way, and so when I have something more poeticized than the Temple Div, I take it over there.
Interesting.
Did you find you have to be in like different moods to write the stuff for the different clans? Like, it seems like you got to put on a different hat each time.
Yeah, but I like to jump around. I like to wear all the hats at once and just kind of throw them on the floor and pick them up, and it's great. And
right. Now, how many cues do you take from the legendary leader of each clan before deciding to go into the flavor, or is it just sort of, I know what these colors are about, let's do it based on
that? I took a lot of cues from who those characters were as people and as with their backstories. And so, we know that Zurgo, as they mentioned in the Comic-Con panel, we know that Zurgo and Sarkhan have
beef.
Some antipathy. Yeah, and
they got beef.
Yeah, they got some beef.
Do they, I'm assuming Craven can do whatever they want, but did you see any instances where they, like, you submitted something for one card, but they slid it over to another card?
Oh, that's a good question. I might be surprised when I see it.
Uh-huh.
When I looked over my acceptances, I could pretty clearly remember, what card they may match up to.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard that happens.
Yeah.
I've heard that's a thing.
I mean, obviously it would be.
They can do whatever they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And they they might change it entirely. It might not even be yours anymore, but they still might pay you for it because, it's what generated their response to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I mean, I've had, I looked at a lot of them and I'd be like, oh, this is edited. I remember what it was. It's this now.
But they still credited you with acceptance for that.
Correct,
that's great.
Correct, yeah.
That's great. Is this Giza from Kong?
Giza is also those are both the two cards.
You guys pronounce her Giza?
Commander.
Giza? Giza?
I've been saying Jissa. I don't know.
Jissa.
That sounds
I've heard Jissa.
So I don't know about that. That's kind of a little close to profanity.
I guess Gisella.
Gisella.
I guess the only two, yeah.
Giza.
Jizza just does sounds bad.
That sounds really bad.
Sounds
yeah.
like someone that's part of the Wu-Tang clan. I think it is.
Ghoul caller Jizza.
That I'm waiting
old
for.
Old dirty Jizza.
Yeah, old dirty Jizza. We need to make that altar happen immediately.
The nerdiest joke of all time.
Do you want to talk about these cards that are spoiled, or would you rather stray?
Oh,
away
they're pretty
them?
Cool. I mean, okay, cool. It's exciting to see her printed as a legend because we got a lot of flavor text from her and her brother Giralf in the Innistrad block, and we got I know they got covered a little bit in the Uncharted Realms column,
right?
And there was definitely there was narrative support for them as a presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember the community at large. There, I heard voices sort of lamenting there. the fact that they didn't arrive, they didn't appear, and that was, it's nice to see her arrive. I mean, we might get Giralf eventually, but I don't really feel the pressure. We've kind of moved beyond Innistrad now. I don't know that we'll go back there, but she's a great card. She's pretty cool. I mean,
yeah,
I
love the art and just the mechanic, and she's just so carefree about her use of the undead.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know if I'd run her as a general. I think I might run her in Grimgrin, maybe.
Oh, yeah, Grimgrin.
That seems helpful.
Yeah, token generator.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if you're sacking Gravecrawler.
With definitely.
Rooftop Stormout with that classic combo. I mean, that just seems fun.
Yeah.
Infinite tokens.
Okay, so before we move on to Commander Spotlight on your deck, James, I do want to ask you one more question. How many boxes of Cons of Tarkir are you personally going to buy?
to get all your cards.
I might just target all the singles. Because, I mean...
It's true. Well, I think that's economically...
Do you know the
much
rarity
awesome.
Of the cards that were
yes,
accepted?
Yes,
so
yeah,
you might have some expensive ones in there.
You never know. What if... Yeah, man, could you imagine?
I mean, the ones that you actually get... I mean, I don't know if you guys know this or if anyone knows this, but one of the wonderful perks about being on the Creative Text team is that you receive a courtesy foil copy of every card to which you have contributed.
Oh, so my goodness.
I probably should have revealed this earlier.
Oh, my goodness.
A delightful perk.
I would only submit for the mythic rares, and that's it.
Well, you see that actually when
do you... work harder on the mythic rares then?
You can't help it. Slave
yeah, you can't help it.
You also have to recognize that your bread and butter... Like your payouts and like, you know,
comments,
it's going to be the comments. Like,
yeah,
and that's
absolutely.
Like, and what are people going to play with most often? Like in draft and limited?
Oh, yeah.
Like, those are going to be the comments. Like,
but the card that's going to live on
in infamy.
Eternally,
the
possibility of a card that like is played in Legacy, you know, still 20 years from now, that's probably a rare or a mythic rare.
Absolutely.
You know, most likely.
Probably, so, yes.
If you want to be immortalized.
Yeah. And who doesn't?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and so,
absolutely.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I have...
So you get a foil copy of each one?
Foil copy of everything. It's amazing. I have a couple foils that I'm very excited to receive.
That's pretty awesome.
But other than that,
are there
any
that are going to go
like,
directly into your commander decks?
Yeah, there are a few.
There are a few.
I'm in a constant rotation of
picks.
So if
and, like how
and then when you
now,
play it on somebody, you can be like, yeah. And
I wrote that, bro.
Yeah.
I wrote that.
I named that card.
Yeah. So the next time you can say that you died to so-and-so.
Yeah.
You died to my
creation. I have more anticipation for other players producing cards that I named. Right?
Oh,
like,
yes.
Oh, I see you like that card. What do you think of that name?
Give me your honest opinion.
Yeah, that's what do you think? Really?
Awesome. So today we're going to have a Commander Spotlight on the deck that you brought in, and it's actually a deck that I've thought about making or just
we chatted about it,
walking into it.
Yeah.
And see what
I think every Johnny in the world was extremely excited to see Krufix, God of Horizons, spoiled.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, our Commander Spotlight is Krufix, God of Horizons. Do you want to read him for us?
He is a 4/7 indestructible for 3, a green and a blue. Legendary enchantment creature, subtype God. As long as your devotion to green and blue is less than 7, Krufix isn't a creature.
Okay.
First ability is you have no maximum hand size. So he's got Reliquary Tower tacked on, and his final ability is a bit like what's his face, Omnath. If unused mana would empty from your mana pool, that mana becomes colorless instead. And I think I applaud them for the economy of that wording.
Definitely.
Basically, that means that any mana you have left that you haven't spent at the end of your turn, it turns into colorless, and then you keep it.
Right. It just hangs out.
At the end of any turn.
Of any turn. Or,
So you can. It's equity that you can bring to your next turn.
Yeah.
Right. So it allows you to accumulate. A comical store of mana, which you can then, you know, apply to obscene uses as a...
Yeah, so the first things this makes me think of, obviously you've got your deck built already, but let me just see if I can nail it.
Go for it.
I mean, first of all, gods are great commanders because there's not a lot of great
ways
answers
to
them.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Right. In want him to stay in
Yeah, you don't want him to be a god.
You spend a lot of time keeping that devotion low.
Yeah, because you don't want the creature, you want the ability, and it's really hard to exile. It's a lot harder to exile an enchantment than it is a creature.
Right.
So that's the first like big upside.
It happened. There's enough spot removal that targets permanents in general.
Yeah.
I'm sure it can happen.
It's just harder.
Yeah, it's definitely much harder. It's wonderful. Yeah.
A lot of people don't really include in their toolbox index specifically god removal. I find Deicide is not like a commonly run card,
no,
you know?
I don't imagine I would run
You need
Deicide,
exile target permanent because nobody's really running exile target enchantment, and that's the only other thing that would do it. So.
Right.
Yeah, you need to exile target permanent, basically.
Sure. Or tuck it. That's it. It's
or
tuck it. Devastating.
Yeah.
Devastating loss.
But it has to be tuck permanent or hinder.
Right.
It's got
to
be Oblation. It's got to be Chaos.
Fortunately, you are in a deck that runs a color that's called blue and has a spell called Counterspell.
That was the thing, is, you know, I was totally enchanted by Omnath. And, like, I mean, enchanted. I loved Omnath as a
You can
a,
be enchanted by Omnath.
Yeah, as like, Krufix is basically an enchanted version of Omnath.
He is. And I was... You know, as a Johnny and as someone who's interested in running with decks that are, you know, that are allow me to do shenanigans.
Yeah,
I was looking at Omnath.
Well, EDH
and, like,
is about shenanigans.
It is.
It's all about
that's the heart and soul of the format, of course. And so I'm looking at Omnath and I'm like, I want to build you, but you are inadequate. You don't have enough. I don't want to play a mono green deck. If I did, I'd
it's really hard
Azusa,
to have enough tools
Yeva,
around it.
Yeah.
I would opt elsewhere. But when they spoiled Krufix, I've always said Krufix. I think the world says Krufix. I might be in the wrong here, but
who knows?
So when they spoiled,
I don't know if we're right, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people say Krufix.
They
I hear Krufix.
They absolutely, and they say Garruk.
Of course, I say Giza
like an absolute pedestrian. Garbage.
Well, Mero recently said it is Garruk.
It is confirmed Garruk.
Confirmed Garruk.
I have to amend.
But it's okay. You can still have your animated gifs and gifts, guys. It's all right. It's up to you. However,
I'll swim
you
with the current.
It.
It's Garruk and Krufix. It's fine. but you know, when I saw what he did, and I saw that he had blue, and I was like, this is possible now. This is there. And in order to keep him under the devotion limit, you run all the counterspells. You run the grip of EDH playable counterspells.
Well, yeah. it feels like there's basically going to be three aspects, right? It's going to be stuff that makes a ton of mana,
right?
Or repeatably use your mana,
right? Mm-hmm.
Stuff that uses that mana to kill people,
correct?
And stuff that stops anything else,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
it's and a wonderful control.
Yeah, and if you want to play control, I mean, you just hang back, and people might think you're dirtling. You know, you're just making up mana, but
They have to know when they see your commander, like, yeah. We can't let him get a ton of mana because he's going to have some way to use it. Like, who puts that commander as their commander and then is like, I have 150 mana, but I have nothing to do.
no threat.
Yeah. Just for fun, guys. I just wanted to see if I could get there.
As long as you can keep the grip, keep the draw going, if you have the resources in your hand, which is pretty standard, if you have the cards, the general gives you the mana, so you're gonna be in a position to just cast Forbid over and over again. Forbid is probably my favorite counterspell in the deck. You know, it's got buyback for the cost of discarding two cards, and after a certain point, you've stroke of genius to yourself for 60, or you stuck a Rhystic Study really early, and you've just been building up stuff. So you know, you counter everything, and it just goes forever.
And I think one thing that you may not immediately realize about Kruphix, which is why he's so great, is that I assume the basic play is leave all your mana up with all your counters, be able to cast cards at flash speed, and let the whole turn go around.
Yep.
And when it finally gets back to you, you can just add that mana to your mana pool forever until you use it, and it untaps and it's your turn
again.
Well,
it's interesting. Like, do you find that, like, what are you doing? You're waiting till end step, and then, okay, I'm going to tap all
and
my
then
mana.
And you tap, leave your lands open, prioritizing colored, because again, Kruphix will turn off the color. It'll make them colorless, and so you can't cast counterspells with those.
Right.
So you want to keep your islands and your blue sources pretty clean. But you're not just waiting until the end step of the person to your right. You're waiting for everybody's end step. And you're using Seedborn Muse and Prophet of Kruphix together, stacking the triggers to get as much mana as possible all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so if you have Prophet of Kruphix and Seedborn Muse out, what happens is Prophet untaps all your lands. You tap them real quick, then Seedborn untaps all your lands.
Not
right.
even real
well, Seedborn
quick.
Seedborn untaps permanents, too.
Right.
Yeah,
so
right.
you're getting your mana rocks in play. And
well,
you know, you
and Prophet
run...
untaps creatures. So.
Right.
Yeah, I was surprised when I looked at your list, there's no, like... there's no real creature producing.
It's a build that I've seen, and it's a way you can go. It does produce creatures on some of the win cons, like Hydra Broodmaster.
I meant mana producing creatures. Yeah.
Oh no. I'm used to metas in which board games or in which board
creatures.
Wipes rule.
Uh-huh.
And I'm used to very frequent Damnations and Day of Judgments, and so I like to play builds that sort of allow those waves to wash over me,
definitely
without wasting all of my gear.
I guess we should actually ask you very quickly about that. What is your meta in your playgroup, and what do you see sort of happen, just so that we can also have a little more information walking into this deck build?
Like, how many people, first of all, are in your
normal
player?
We're playing like 5 to 9 person games. And then,
you play a game with 9 people at once?
It's untenable. I hate doing it. It's boring.
Why don't you split that into four and five.
That's what we're sort of getting to the point now.
That's crazy, dude.
We have
six is too big.
It's like one of those.
Six is the worst number because 3 sucks and 6 sucks.
Yeah. You guys are like in a clown car
of
magic
over
there.
It's really dumb.
Everyone
takes so long, and you just go make a meal between your turns.
You just play a three-headed giant.
Yeah.
3v3v3.
Ooh,
but
yeah,
my point is that we have a lot of dudes in my living room.
Okay. Well, no wonder there's so many board wipes. So if you're playing with 9 people,
you want to
exactly.
Everyone's
the board.
Like, somebody has a board wipe on every turn.
Yeah, honestly, it's brutal. And so
is your game fast? Like, what turn does it usually end on, would you say?
Late. They're pretty long. They go for a while. Because people are...
They're just blowing the world up all the time?
They're blowing up the world. They're casting chaos. The chaos card, like just the silly red.
Oh, gosh.
Warp World.
They're casting Warp World.
We have really, people are out to do shenanigans. but people are also out to win. And Kruphix,
right.
I feel like, is...
Is there anyone out just to make infinite creatures and swing?
It happens. Yeah, we have
well,
a
you
deck.
Kind of are.
Yeah,
I
it's not infinite
man, yeah.
creatures, but
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
they're not infinite. There's I make a point of counting exactly how many there are because I want that number to ring out. You know,
yeah.
it's dramatic.
Not just
every
I make
time.
Some arbitrary number. It's
man,
like, no,
9
this is
people
exact.
Is a
right.
lot of
that,
people.
That's too many. It isn't always that big. We actually play on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. And if your playgroup is looking for a good time to find a time when everyone's there, I suggest you try it. Just give it a shot one time. Because be honest with yourself, what are you doing Sunday morning time? If you're not in church, you're in bed. and it's
or like, making breakfast.
We're making breakfast,
but you
just,
have no plans
and,
otherwise.
And you have no plans otherwise. You might get together later with your friends in the afternoon and stuff. But by then, it's kind of Sunday night. You got to get ready for the week. Start your Sunday off with like wake up and have your friends show up, and, you know, maybe you're the host, so maybe make a big pot of oatmeal for him and like brew coffee, and everyone shows up and everyone's so excited to start their day with this game we love, and it's great.
Yeah. And I would do Sunday morning drafts. I think I could make that part.
Yeah, like if someone's got a box of Innistrad.
Yeah. I'll do draft anytime.
I just recently got a box of Modern Masters, just waiting to get drafted.
That's exciting.
We just drafted it last week.
We are spoiled.
Would you guys pull anything cool?
I did pull a foil Elspeth. I have the touch.
He's got the touch. I never pull anything. I pulled the best deck.
You do have the best. You do have some of the most value.
What did you play? What was your build?
Rebels.
Yeah. Dude, all Rebels all day. You were tutoring for Rebels like every turn for two. Oh, my gosh.
I had a Rebels deck and it had about 14 Rebels in it.
That's
and
great.
Six Rebel Searchers. It was broken.
It's pretty wild.
Okay, let's talk about, let's get back to your deck here and talk about a few more of the cards. I see Doubling Cube.
Doubling Cube is the heart and soul of the deck.
It seems like.
Yeah. It is truly the heart and soul of the deck. And I bought that foil randomly because I thought the card was exciting way before, you know, like a year before Kruvix was spoiled, and it's exciting. I'm sure that foil, that price has gone up way more than I paid for it.
Especially with Kruvix.
Because of Kruvix.
Let me read it really quick. It's two mana for an artifact. It says pay three and tap it. Double the amount of each type of mana in your mana pool.
Right.
So I'm assuming this is usually doubling your colorless.
I mean, it often hits colorless, but if you do it on your turn and there's a bunch of, and you've just tapped all your lands into it, at that point you essentially have an arbitrary amount of colored mana to play with.
You don't really explode the game.
Oh, that's true, because you have all the colorless saved from your previous turns.
Right, yeah.
And so you just use three of those, and you just double your mana, basically, colored mana.
Yeah,
and then that's all going to spill into.
Right, well, Voltaic Key, and then you pop it open, double Kira's again.
Kira's Follower,
pop it again.
Yeah, a lot of ways to untap it.
Yeah, Tezzeret the Seeker, pop them again.
Right. So you can literally, like, in one turn, if you, that's like two to the fourth power.
Yeah, it's exponential, and that's the point, is when you have a word like double.
You need a calculator when you play this deck.
At a certain, I've been sort of, you know, kind of enforcing the arithmetic on myself, but after a certain number of digits, you kind of get over.
Right. You're just like, I'm above a million.
Yeah, I'm over. Yeah, my record for mana production in this deck is 15 million.
Wow.
I play Vedalken Orrery, pass turn. In his end step, I flash in a Gelatinous Genesis with 15 million mana, and it was like 3,500 million.
A lot of gelatinous power and toughness.
It just said you're dead.
It was just silly. It's just goofy. Or like alternatively, you can there are draw spells in the deck, things like Stroke of Genius and Blue Sun Zenith.
Right. Let's talk about your finishers actually.
Yeah,
you have several options here to win, essentially. One of them is mill. You've got cards like Stroke of Genius in there, Blue Sun Zenith. Oh, these are all essentially make someone draw their deck.
Well, I
out.
Like something like Stroke of Genius because it's dual purpose, right? If I have it and I'm at a modest amount of mana for this deck, would be like what, 30-ish?
Yeah, that's really modest. That's very low.
So then I can fire it off to go find all the pieces I need to really get into the 15 million range.
30 seems low.
You wouldn't draw 30?
If I'm digging for pieces, I will draw 30 if it's dire. You know, if I'm doing it in response,
if it's dire,
I'm looking
30 cards into my hand. That sounds about right.
I'd like to hold on. I'd like to hold out for 50. I'd like to maybe 60, depending on what my library is like.
You don't find that if you say I cast this and draw 50 cards, that the whole table doesn't turn to kill you, because that's what happened in our game.
What are they going to do? I now have 50 counterspells. Like I have so like you know, I have a big hand. I feel great. Drawing 50 cards. I mean, of course I would, but like,
I mean, I think a lot of us would feel great if we.
But I mean, you had to spend 50 mana to do it, and presumably, if they let you get to 300 mana, you.
I would not have done that if I didn't have the colorless then to protect myself after the effect. You spend as much colorless as you can, prioritizing and really preserving those colored mana sources for moments like that, for defending those plays, and so you're digging. First of all, you're probably going to hit Pact of Negation if you don't have it already. That's fine. That doesn't help. That doesn't cost anything. But then you're going to get into a lot of defensive plays like Evacuation or Aether Spouts or something. You don't have access to true board wipes, but you can definitely keep aggression at bay.
Right.
The goal is to have it not matter how angry the table is at you. Mm-hmm. You just have a vulgar display of power in which it doesn't like people let them try.
Let them try that vulgar display of power.
I actually can't take credit for it. That was one of my housemates said that to me after a glorious Kruvix win.
I see. Let's talk about some of your counters. Actually, I thought Trickbind was a really good addition to this deck, and actually for a lot of EDH, because I'll read the text on it. It's one in a blue for an instant that has split second. So as long as it's on the stack, it's the last thing on there. You can't essentially counter that. It says counter target activated or triggered ability. If a permanent's ability is countered this way, activated abilities of that permanent can't be played this turn.
Right. I think this card should see a lot more EDH play. I think it's a wonderful counter spell, especially for generals that have an activated ability.
Right. I'm thinking specifically of Prosh. You know, someone that has a sac outlet built into them, and I think it's great because it's says, you know, like there's a card called that was reprinted in Conspiracy that is just Stifle. You just do it once.
Oh, right.
And like, it's like, well, that's great, but what
it's
if they just
helpful.
Do it again?
And in EDH, the difference between one and two mana is less pronounced than other
Right.
Than other
yeah, absolutely. So
it's
I,
basically not even there.
Yeah. So that's why I like
Especially
Trick
Bind.
Yeah.
Because you have the ability to actually stop, at least buy yourself that much extra time to do something if it is a general that could go infinite, you know, in that turn if you don't stop it.
Let's talk about
Sponsor.
You were saying how you only
Log.
Need 30 mana with this guy.
you only. I love the math
mana,
that's
though.
Happening at this
it
table.
It is actually
Krufix,
very
with
easy.
With Krufix, it's
even,
very easy.
Even if you're super modest and let's say the worst happened, you had a horrible draw, you only have 6 mana on the table.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's still, like, if you just get Prophet of Krufix, that's once around the table.
It's also exciting because this card sees play nowhere. Where would you play this card? It was actually someone on Reddit made the suggestion, like, in as a potential win con for Krufix, and I immediately threw it in, and then went ahead and found a bunch of Eldrazi cards and sleeved them up in appropriate gray sleeves, which and I keep them in the box with the deck in the event that I will get to do this.
You want to read it?
Let's hear that.
Right. So Sponsor of Ulamog is a 7/11 for 10 colorless. It's an Eldrazi with Annihilator 1. He has 2 activated abilities. The first is for 4 colorless without a tap symbol. You may put 2/0/1 colorless Eldrazi spawn creature tokens onto the battlefield. And they, as we know, have the ability to sacrifice this creature to add 1 colorless mana to your mana pool.
And the big one.
And most importantly, for 20 colorless mana. And without the tap symbol, you could presumably do this more than once.
Although, why?
Yeah, right?
You shouldn't have to because...
You shouldn't have to because it says.
For 20 colorless, you may cast any number of Eldrazi cards you own from outside the game without paying their mana costs.
Yeah, so this card is interesting because it says something, 3 words that you very rarely see on Magic cards, which is outside the game.
Yeah, and people take issue with this. Many people wish you never saw these words. This is... This mechanic is a point of contention, I believe, in the play.
Sponsor of Ulamog, I can see why people take issue of it, because it's not like what's in your deck. So it's like, oh, it might be in my hand or my graveyard, but no, it's from anywhere. It could be in Albania.
Yeah.
And you would have to fly over and grab those cards, and you could legally cast them if
usually
you
flew back. It means what this means is in tournament play is in your sideboard.
Right.
You can't do anything from your collection. Now in a kitchen table game, it gets a little bit
I host my EDH play groups, so I can just walk over to the shelf.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't only play at home, so I keep them there here, I keep them sleeved up, carry them around with the deck.
And do you have to limit yourself, I don't even know the ruling on this, to singleton still?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would actually love to hear.
I think so, because I think in EDH, like, you're not allowed to have 2 of the same card
in play. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean,
like, you can't be the owner of 2 of the same card that's currently in the game.
You can't be the owner. Yes, you can certainly control another copy of a card if someone else brought it to the table. I don't know the official ruling on that. I've kept the singleton. The singleton rule out of respect for the format.
There's still a lot of choices there. You can still drop like a whole bunch of Eldrazi on the table and kill everybody.
It's still goofy.
And I think it's very flavorful. You can't be dropping 2 of the biggest guys that already exist, 2 Ulamogs. That doesn't make any sense.
No, kind of most importantly, what really seals the deal is casting All Is Dust and It That Betrays at the same time.
You stack it. Yeah. No, it doesn't matter. You don't even
have to. Same time. They interplay at the same time because they're coming into play with the sponsor ability. Mm-hmm. But so All Is Dust is a colorless
board wipe
tribal sorcery Eldrazi for 7.
Yeah.
Each player sacrifices all colored permanents he or she controls. And which is meaningful because it tells us to sacrifice. And now It That Betrays is an 11/11 Eldrazi for 12 with Annihilator 2. Most importantly, he says, whenever an opponent sacrifices a non-token permanent, put that card onto the battlefield under your control.
Yeah, so you just get everything.
It's just exciting. It's like a Johnny's dream. Mm-hmm. This is a
and not
dream
a Johnny
moment.
The Planeswalker, a Johnny.
No, as the psychographic profile, those who like to build decks that win, but win in their way. And
absolutely.
Create an
win
interesting
in style.
Way. Win in
yeah,
style.
Win
you
in
know,
style.
What is more stylish than having the God of Horizons, the God of Mystery, like tear a hole in the plane and just like... dump a bunch of these, you know, like colorless like kaiju into wherever you guys are and just have them eat the world.
Like, there you go. That's an altar right there. It's a kaiju altar.
And that's the flavor. It's the kind of like the flavor fun of this deck is that, you know, he is the god of mysteries and he can win in a variety of dramatic and sort of mysterious ways. Like he can fill your brain with too much knowledge so that you die. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
You know, he can bring the Eldrazi in. He can do whatever Helix Pinnacle is doing.
I love Helix Pinnacle, which is just 100. It's like 100 mana.
It's hard from a flavor perspective to explain what that card's doing. It's just you want to read it?
I mean, yeah, sure. So it's an interesting enchantment. It's a green enchantment for one green mana. It has Shroud. Just to rub it in.
You don't see a lot of enchantments with Shroud.
Shroud. No, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so it has the ability at instant speed, no tapping. Of course, no tapping. It's an enchantment. But you may pay X colorless to put X tower counters on Helix Pinnacle. At the beginning of your upkeep, if there are 100 or more tower counters on Helix Pinnacle, you win the game.
You win the game.
You just win. So the beginning of your upkeep.
And with Krufix, not too far out of reach.
Really, really within reach.
In fact, one of the few cards that I think Krufix is just like, oh yeah, that... I can add that to my wheelhouse.
It was an auto-include. I think the whole community recognized that at once when they saw Krufix, and it's actually probably my least favorite way to win. It's pretty boring.
Yeah, I can understand why.
I would prefer to sponsor.
Right. So, I mean, obviously you really enjoy the flavor of these cards as you are playing them with the God of Mystery. Do you find that influences your deck building for EDH?
No. We should not have to sacrifice performance in the game in order to have good flavor. Flavor that doesn't actually manifest in the game doesn't matter. It is actually like, you know, like there is inherent value in narrative and flavor and stuff, but I don't care what your deck does if it never does it. If it can do it, if it's like, oh, my deck is so flavorful, it's this cool story, like it's got this thing set up, like this can win in that way, and it's going to be like, does it do that? Do you actually get to do that in the game? Is it good enough to do it? And so if you're playing these games where like your deck has, you know, magnificent potential, but it doesn't actually materialize, I don't actually find that valuable as a player. I don't really enjoy that experience. And so I allowed that to push me into a more competitive design space as a player and as a thinker.
Yes, definitely.
Johnny still want to win games.
Yeah, are you having fun if you lose? Because I don't.
So getting back to the Krufix deck, what do you find is something that the deck has problems with? Like when the deck stumbles, or when, you know, you're not winning games. Like,
it's all about those early plays. It's all about the beginning. If you can stick a turn one exploration and just like race ahead into the ramping stuff, you're going to be in a great position because you want to have a big grip. You want to have card advantage, just like any deck. But you're very vulnerable in the beginning when you're just playing. You're getting your little your dirty.
Are there certain
rock
cards that are just like because you don't? It looks like you have a lot of counters and stuff, but if something actually makes it on the table, like...
Yeah, a good aggressive creature that's just, like, wailing into me. I mean, in earlier builds, I was running fog effects because I needed time.
Right. But no longer is that an issue?
No longer. It's less an issue now. The ramp package
is tighter.
What about,
a meddling mage or a Nevermore?
That would be brutal. I don't see Nevermore in my playgroup, in my meta. That level of hate has not showed up.
Nevermore, people. Nevermore.
Meddling Mage.
If you want to win games and you put Nevermore, like, you can shut down basically any EDH. It'll change your whole playgroup.
Yeah.
I imagine
everyone
that
will have to start running exile enchantment effects. Like,
for
you
sure.
have to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, run removal. Like, you should always be running removal, and it should be a diverse package of removal to be able to handle whatever comes your way. But that is a brutal play. I have not seen.
Are there any other cards that like you could think of that like they hit the table and you're just like, oh crap?
We have a Heartless Hidagetsu deck in the meta,
yes.
And that is particularly threatening because it's symmetrical and it doesn't matter what I'm doing. It doesn't matter how much mana I have.
And you have trouble.
I can trick bind it once, but like, you know, it's those kind of decks that don't care how much mana I have and are just messing with my life thing. Like, you know, some decks you can really, you can consume life as a resource. This is not one of them. You're going to get hit a couple times in the beginning, maybe.
Right.
And so
getting a fast start before you're able to get the mana you need to do silly, crazy shenanigans.
Yeah, and if the playgroup's smart and they've seen what it does, they'll hit you early.
That's what I was thinking is, like, once you pull out, like, 15 million mana one time, like, I feel like... Yeah.
From that
in our
point
playground,
on.
It's like, oh, you flip over that card? All
right.
Everyone's just going to attack
full
you.
Right, definitely. Yeah, like, it's like, you're going to be threatening later. You're dirtling now, but I know what happens later, so you're dead now.
And it makes it easier for everyone to be like, okay, good, we don't need to argue with each other about who we should swing at.
It's clearly the Krufix player.
Yeah, it's this guy. Yeah, it's great.
Right, but the as I said before, the point is to is to have enough mana, have enough cards, and have included enough counterspells that you get to laugh that off. It's so wonderful. It's just great to like fight down a whole table that has allied against you and to just stand there as the god of horizons and just let them falter. It's great. It's wonderful.
I mean, that's definitely why I play games, is to get to that point where the deck has done what it needs to do and the commander is being the commander.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, every ADH deck has to be designed with that moment in mind, right? Like, where you're going to win and the whole table can't stop you, even if they, like, realize it and try.
And try their absolute hardest.
Right, it's like you guys realize too late.
Yep.
Now, do you find that this deck, if Krufix just gets countered, hindered, tucked, just sort of falls flat?
No, because the dig is so strong, you're going to get him back.
Right, right.
If you do lose him and you lose that mana,
thinking is like your dig is basically based on having 50 mana or 100 mana or whatever. So if he gets tucked, then you lose it the next upkeep.
It's pretty rough. It's a scary play. You try to not let those happen.
You just don't open yourself up to it. On what turn do you cast him? Do you cast him on turn 5, or do you wait until you have like a grip of counter spells?
It's definitely risky. I'd prefer to cast him before turn 5.
Right, of course.
But I often do. Turn 5, let it go. He is indestructible. The tucking effects.
So hinder is the only thing you're worried about when you do it?
I am definitely scared of hinder and spell crumple for sure. I'm very scared of ablation. Ablation and Chaos Warp are scary cards to see.
Chaos Warp is very, very scary and possibly the best red removal there is.
I think it's probably the best red removal for sure, at least in this format.
Absolutely.
Because it's a singleton format. In a regular deck, you have 4 copies of anything and your deck's a lot thinner. It's not as good. Tucking is a vulnerability.
It's true. I guess tucking really kind of does shut down any deck that runs around its commander. Now, are there ways outside of card draw that your deck is sort of built to potentially function without its commander? It's a question that we ask of every deck. You know, does this deck work and still accomplish its synergistical means?
Or at least does it have a chance to? You know, a lot of decks okay, you're going to be crippled, but you might be able to still limp your way across the finish line.
Mm-hmm. I mean, without Krufix, without the accumulation of mana, you're still making a lot of it. You're still a very well-off blue and green control build.
Right.
You can at least not die.
You can stall for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Gives you a chance to draw him again and get back on the rails.
And if not, you'll just make 30 mana and spawn sire in the middle of your turn.
You can do
it's
that
fine.
Naturally
yeah.
even without him. I mean, 30's, yeah. 30's a lot, but it's not.
Yeah, it definitely happens.
Well, with doubling cube, anything is possible. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you can untap it once or twice.
Yeah. It's glorious.
I'm guessing you don't very often find yourself attacking with Krufix. Because he's just not a creature.
I've done it. it's happened, but he doesn't turn on as a creature until you're about to win in other ways. Mm-hmm. Typically, you don't want him to be devoted.
You don't want him to be vulnerable, right?
You really don't. Yeah. You want him to stay as ethereal and mysterious as possible. Phyrexian Metamorph copies Doubling Cube. That's fun.
This deck is another testament to the power of Prophet of Krufix, though. That deck, I don't care what your deck's doing. If you're playing green and blue in any combination of whatever other colors, like that card will do something in your deck. Like, just put it in there.
It's excellent.
It's crazy. Yeah.
I take it you guys saw the alternate art foil they printed in the Clash Packs.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely gorgeous.
Beautiful.
I don't have it yet. We need one.
I want one. I need like four decks that have that.
Yeah.
Like, every EDH deck I build has Prophet Krufix in it. Yeah.
If I go around and look at a deck and it's those colors, I'll think, well, even if I don't have any decks in these colors, I'll probably need to at least get a couple of Prophet of Krufixes because they're just going to be so useful.
It's almost like Consecrated Sphinx in the level of whining you hear around it.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have to ban this. And it's like, just kill it.
Well,
just
when you're playing with 9 other people at the table, it's absolutely freaking crazy broken.
But that's 9 opportunities for removal.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's also 9 times you get to untap your lands
and counter
the removal.
Yeah.
But you have to have the card draw.
That's true.
All right, very cool, man. Well, thanks for joining us.
It's been wonderful. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
I feel like we should play a game of EDH now.
We're going to have to maybe combine our play groups or maybe like a couple people from...
Absolutely.
I don't think we can support we'll take some over for 13
You should just come to a Sunday gathering and we'll break up into smaller pods.
That's
what we did last time, the first time. I don't know if you guys do this or if any of our listeners do this, but you guys, we're thinking about having a big dry erase marker board. I got one from Goodwill for $5. It's been in the yard for doing nothing. We have a freestanding studio garage. We call it the studio because it sounds cool.
Definitely sounds cool.
Sounds great. It's better than the garage. So we have this huge thing, and I'm thinking about maybe instituting like a merit badge system where, like, you know, as we play, we organically award, like, oh, you took out three players at once, you get the triple kill merit badge, and you write it up on the board next to your name. Or think about implementing a system like that. And so,
sort of an achievement system.
Yes, exactly. Yes, you guys are totally
achievement unlocked.
Yeah.
Triple kill.
I think that'll definitely affect the meta a bit if someone's like, this week I'm going to get the quadra kill.
Yeah,
it's going to happen. I'm going to kill four people at once.
You guys are welcome to come and add your names to that board. start accumulating merit badges as we do awesome things.
We'll see you there in that case.
That is a cool idea.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, James. Where can we find you online for those that are interested?
Please follow me on Twitter. My handle is jamespianca.com. That's P like pizza, I, A, N as in Nancy, K as in kitchen, A.
But not dot com. James Pianca is your
at
Twitter.
At James Pianca?
At James Pianca is my Twitter handle. I have my portfolio is up online at jamespianca.com.
Gotcha.
It's professional, but, you know, in this industry, so fun. But if you want to get in touch, Twitter is where I live online. I will be upfront about that, though, I do not tweet about Magic almost ever. I'm involved in a comedy writing scene on Twitter, and so I am telling jokes and retweeting jokes, and it will very rarely cater to gaming interests, but if you like comedy, I would love to see you.
I don't think I can find anyone that doesn't like comedy.
Right.
You know, so that's great to know. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm very excited to see what cards, and excited for you to show me the foil versions of the cards that you wrote for.
Yeah, once the set's finally out, you can tell us like which cards are yours. And
absolutely.
Then,
and then speak more at length about what it was like to talk about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will be unshackled by the NDA once.
Ah, you will be Obnixilus.
Like Obnixilus, yeah.
We did it, guys. We're bringing Magic into real life. How? All over again.
Yeah, it'll be great.
All right, guys.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys, for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, everybody. Unfortunately, Jimmy and I will be out of town this week. So next week, that's Tuesday, August 26th, there will be no episode. But don't worry, we've got more great topics and awesome special guests coming up for you starting the first Tuesday in September. So thank you for listening and stay tuned. Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.